Welcome to WISO Weekend, WISO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. On today's program, a conversation with Canal Street Tavern's Mick Montgomery. Last week, news broke that Montgomery was selling the music venue. We talked to Mick about that and what's next for him. This month, professor of education at Wittenberg University, Lowell Monke, will speak at Antioch College about the effects of social media and other technologies on the younger generation. We'll have a preview for you. And later in the program, Conrad Balliet speaks with poet Kathy Austin. Up first in this week's news, born in Dayton and raised in Springfield, comedian Jonathan Winters' breakneck improvisations inspired the likes of Robin Williams, Jim Carrey, and many others. Winters died Thursday at the age of 87. In the mid-1950s, the Jonathan Winters Show pioneered the then new videotape technology that allowed Winters to show up as two characters on screen together. Later, he was introduced to millions of new fans in 1981 as the son of Robin Williams' goofball alien in the final season of ABC's Mork and Mindy. Next week on Why So Weekend, we will feature a tribute to Jonathan Winters. Civil rights groups and others are taking issue with the Dayton City Commission's proposal to enter into a contract with a company that provides aerial surveillance for the city to monitor crime. Opponents fear it will lead to privacy violations. WISO's Emily McCord spoke with Dayton Police Chief Richard Beal about the issue and the technology involved.
Yeah, it is enhanced video imagery that can be captured from the air. The flight level is roughly about 8,900. This is a camera imagery attached to a Cessna plane. It is piloted. And basically about a 25-square-mile area can be monitored all at one time. Now, the imagery is downlinked to basically computer software that if a crime event occurs, we can identify an individual or vehicle at that scene. They can be tagged electronically and tracked through computer software so we can see not only where they came from but where they went to after leaving the crime scene.
So how's this going to work? Is there going to be a robbery? You get a call and you say, dispatch the planes, or is that what happens?
No, actually what we're going to do is we identify crime patterns because this is expensive technology. It is labor-intensive in terms of personnel to do the forensic analysis based on the imagery to follow up on crime events. So we will identify crime patterns that are already in existence and then to basically fly the plane at times that we think additional crimes are going to occur in the hope to be able to capture these events and then use this video imagery and the computer tracking to follow suspects and vehicles to place where their identification can be determined through some secondary means, so another ground sensor, meaning another camera on the ground, and or witnesses that are identified on the ground, or actually having a police officer respond to a location, do we know where the suspect went.
You're talking about a lot of analysis and an expensive piece of technology. Right. Are you just hoping to get lucky to catch a crime there?
No, actually, it's because of using pattern analysis. We hope not to be lucky. We hope to be very focused and strategic in its use. So we're going to deploy it at times we have every reason to believe another event will occur. To just fly and hope you'll be lucky would be extremely costly and very ineffective.
Now, is this going to be surveillance 24 hours a day all the time?
Yeah, actually, it's a great question because, you know, that's been – I don't want to be – somebody be able to watch me around the clock. This is 120 hours over 3 months, and it's not 120 hours continuous. The flights are roughly 4 hours before the plane has to refuel. So 4-hour increments strategically determined based on pattern analysis over a series of days, weeks, or months.
What is to say, though, that this technology won't be used for other reasons that are outside of crime?
See, I've heard that question before. I mean, first of all, I go back. It's crime is our focus here. We have no interest in monitoring what citizens are doing in normal activity. We have no interest, we have no intent to do that. And I would say if that intent did exist, you don't need this technology to do it. I mean, that's the other part of this, is if this technology would provide a capability that wouldn't exist by just deploying current resources to do the very same thing. So, you know, those who think, well, this technology, that doesn't go through, well, then we're certain no one can ever monitor what I'm doing. No, if police really wanted to do that, it could be done, correct, with current resources. So, the argument that having the technology not available will prevent that from occurring is really a false argument.
Not exactly a comforting thought there.
But that's the reality of it, right? I mean, the greatest thing about this country is that is because of transparency of government. Everything we do is a matter of public record. for the most part, subject to public disclosure. Now, not a current active investigation. That's protected. It is a public record because it can thwart getting to the truth and accomplishing justice. But everything government does, at least in Ohio, because of the public records law, is subject to disclosure to citizens at any time for any reason without even a written request. That's the transparency of government. That's the protection.
So after something happens, the public will have access to seeing how this technology was used?
Anyone. It doesn't have to be, you know, someone who is a civil libertarian or civil rights advocate saying, I want access. Any citizen could walk in and say, I want to see. Now, the computer, and even including the analysis once a criminal case is conducted. And, oh, by the way, any information acquired, if it's part of a prosecution, a criminal case, that's subject to all the legal safeguards in our legal system. So if it is believed to be obtained illegally, that can be challenged in court. So there are checks and balances in place to really prevent any of this from being used improperly. First and foremost, I'll say it's the integrity of the men and women of the Dayton Police Department.
WISO's Emily McCord speaking with Dayton Police Chief Richard Beal. In 1981, Dayton's own Mick Montgomery turned an old factory cafeteria into the iconic music venue, Canal Street Tavern. Last week, it was announced that Mick was selling Canal Street to Bill Daniels, owner of Pizza Factory and South Park Tavern. News of the sale spread last week on social media, upsetting many, but Montgomery says he'll still be involved with the club, and for now, not much will change. First, I asked him what the club has meant to him over the last 30-plus years.
Well, that's a hard one, I'll be honest with you. It's been my life, really. People don't realize having a small business how many hours it typically takes of your week. People talk about a full-time job being 40 hours. It's to laugh, you know. But the truth is that I've had some incredible help over the years and incredible staff who helped me get started and who's worked with me over the years. And I can't describe it in any other way than it's just been a very gratifying, good experience. The artists and the acts that I've met over the years and gotten to know a little bit have been wonderful. It's been, again, a great experience. Back in the early days, everybody used to, when they came to town, they used to crash on my floor over here and used to be wall-to-wall sleeping bags. There were nights when I had a whole Irish or Scottish bands in here and that type of thing, you know. Some pretty famous people and some people that went out of their way to just be regular people, you know. The other part of it has been the connection with local musicians over the year. Over the years, the local music scene here is amazing for a town the size of Dayton. And I don't think that a lot of the locals really take it as seriously as they should. There's not a lot of credit given for just what does actually happen in this town as far as musicians and creativity and bands and so forth. And I've been proud to be a part of that, too. I should say that, you know, we've been talking about this getting together on this deal for quite a long time, and when we came to the conclusion that it would be a win-win for my involvement to remain as the booking person there, I think that was when we really started settling the deal, because I'm not a spring chicken anymore, and I'm ready to turn things over to someone who can take care of things and keep the tradition alive. I'm proud of what Canal Street means on a national level and on a local level, but people don't realize the reputation that in the touring industry that the club actually has. It's so incredibly rare for a small concert venue to exist these days because it's so expensive to be on the road and to tour that everybody's amazed that I'm still there year after year, you know.
You mentioned that you're staying on as the booking agent. That's a great thing, certainly for the bands that you've built relationships with over the years, and it's a good thing for you. And tell me a little bit about the details of the sale. It will stay branded as Canal Street.
Yes, part of that deal is that I have a contract to be the exclusive booker for the club and the venue. I've started a new company called Canal Street Concerts, and we'll be kind of as an outside contractor for them. And I hope to work very closely with some of their guys about what they have, some of the ideas they have. We expect that this year's summer's Dayton Band Playoffs are going to be a big event. We're really hoping to get all of the local bands back excited and involved like back in the day. There were years when we had 50 or 60 bands sign up and be in that, and it was just amazing. In general, it really isn't going to be connected necessarily with South Park Tavern. It's a totally different company that has bought the property and the license from me. And Bill Daniels is the fellow who's the owner of both Pizza Factory and South Park. And he's a guy that I've known for a long time. He actually rented the kitchen space out back in the early 90s and did pizzas in there before he got his location out on Wayne Avenue. So I think it's a very good, simpatico relationship, you know. And I hope that we'll be able to work together as far as booking with what's going on over at South Park as well.
I guess just one final comment or question for you. You mentioned that people in the city of Dayton perhaps underappreciate the local band scene here. But when you talk to fans who have been a part of the music scene at Canal Street for the last 20, 30 years, they talk about concerts like they just happened yesterday. There was some amazing stuff taking place there.
I've had so many wonderful conversations in the last couple of weeks from people just reminiscing or having nostalgia about different things that happened to them, from meeting their spouse or having a wedding at the club or seeing some show back in the 80s that they've still got fresh in their mind. Just like you say, they remember it like it was the best show they ever saw. Somebody was talking about the Taj Mahal show that was here back in the 80s the other night. And it just brought back all these memories for me, too, because, you know, it kind of starts getting to where it fades one night to the next. Somebody brings up a special event or an occasion like that, and it just, bingo, it's back in my mind. And it was really fun to think about, for instance, the staff that was in the club at that time. And there was a particular incident that happened that night that we laughed about. And, you know, Taj just did one of the most magnificent shows you could imagine. And he just rose to the occasion because the place was just packed. And it was the kind of wall-to-wall energy that you just can't get in an arena, you know. And he just got into the show that night amazingly. And there's been so many nights that things like that happened. And some of the, you know, people like Alison Krauss coming in and playing in a 200-seat club, that's just unheard of these days, you know. And it kind of got hard to bring those acts in. Even like here in the recent past, some of the bigger acts that were on their way to blowing up when we had them were people like the Avett Brothers. And so we'd get them once, and the next time around, they were playing in theaters already, you know. And it's partly because it's so expensive to be touring and to be on the road. But on that national stage, we used to be quite involved in some of the big conferences that happen every year in the touring industry. And I made a lot of really good friends with people that ran other venues and agents and agencies who promote cutting-edge new artists, you know. And that's really what I care about. That's my passion, you know.
Do you have, or could you describe your documentation of what's taken place over there since Canal Street started?
Yes, I intend to. And the name Canal Street will be with me until our contract runs out, and then it will revert to the new owners. And in the meantime, one of the things that I hope to be able to do, we're trying to put a new piece into our website, canalstreettavern.com, that we have a calendar there that shows upcoming events, and we're trying to fix it so that we can go backwards. And if we can do that, and I'm being told that we can, people will be able to actually go back to 1982 and remember just exactly who opened for that show that they were at, you know. And I'm excited about that. That's going to take a lot of time and work, I think, but that's going to be fun, and I've had a lot of people express an interest in that. I mentioned the band playoffs before. That's another thing that people have definitely had an interest in, what year who won and who came in second, you know. And I think we're going to try to put a little part on the website about the history of the band playoffs and who has won it every year, too.
Well, I'm sure you'll have no shortage of people even interested in helping with the project. As you said, it is a lot of work. So
I've had a couple of people already volunteer, and that's true. People have offered to help me for so many years, do little things, and frankly, sometimes I'm just amazed. I'm humbled by some of people's responses to things. In the last couple of weeks, I've been blushing quite a bit, so, you know.
Mick Montgomery, I really appreciate your time. Good luck with everything, and also good luck with Canal Street Concerts.
Hey, Jerry, thanks very much. I appreciate you, too. And I appreciate the public's interest in what we're doing.
You're listening to WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO, and thanks for joining us online at wyso.org. This week on April 18th, Professor of Education at Wittenberg University, Lowell Monkey, will engage an audience at Antioch College in a conversation about unplugging narcissists, why a high-tech society needs a high-touch childhood. It's about the effects of social media and other technologies on the younger generation. In an interview with WYSO, he explains how this issue became a priority for him.
I think part of it really started when I was brought to a meeting by the head of my school and the IT director for Des Moines Schools, and they asked me to do some experimenting with this new thing called the World Wide Web, you know, which turned into the Internet. No one had it in the schools. They didn't know what to make of it. And so they asked me to experiment with my class because it was the most advanced class in the district at the time. So I said, okay. And then they gave me the other side of the issue, which was that if things went wrong and kids got a hold of inappropriate material, it's going to be my neck in the news, which put a little bit different kind of sense of what I was involved with into my head. So I remember the day that we got all the wires all hooked up, and I was about to sit down to test the thing, and it dawned on me that I was about to hand to these young people the power to do more damage to more people from a longer distance than probably any generation of young people had ever had. And the question that popped into my head was, who's prepared them for this? How have we prepared them for that responsibility? And the obvious answer was we hadn't. And so then I started wondering, well, what are those responsibilities? How do we go about preparing kids so that they have the kinds of inner strength that they need to take on these kinds of tasks and this kind of technology responsibly and with some kind of self-discipline? So that's what I've really been working on ever since, and it's kind of exploded as I've investigated, other types of technology and the amount of time that kids spend with it, and all of the issues that go along with their use of all the digital technology that they have at their disposal now.
Comment, if you can, about kind of the lost simplicity of teaching and learning. Some of the greatest minds in the history of the world have been formed with maybe one or two books at their disposal, very little technology for getting that information. Can you speak to that?
Yeah. You can go back all the way to Plato, who believed that the only real learning took place through dialogue. There's an old saying that says real education takes place when two minds come together to pursue it. So that kind of simple, kind of straightforward, and usually face-to-face interaction still, I think, is really an essential part of education. But what the technology, in my experience, really alters and in some senses takes away is the reliance on a sort of common experience or experience in the physical world altogether. What's happened with digital technology that I see that's really altered the landscape is that education has become much more a matter of information sharing and transferring rather than coming to grips with one's firsthand experience. And without that firsthand experience, the information really becomes pretty dead. And I'm really concerned with that because of the not just the way that the technology is being used, but the amount at which kids are interacting with digital technology, which is really nothing but information. That's what computers do. They process information. And symbols. Well, what are those symbols about? If you don't have firsthand experience to symbolize or to attach those symbols to, it makes your experience rely simply on the symbols themselves, which don't carry a whole lot of emotional or psychological weight to them. And right now, with kids spending, I believe the latest Kaiser study said, 7 hours and 45 minutes in front of screens, you're not getting a whole wealth of experience in the real world for those symbols to get attached to. That's where I think that the problem really lies. It's not so much in the dialogue or even the face-to-face, although that's, I think, is crucial. It's really in the fact that so much of what children's lives are now are based on their consumption of kind of detached symbolic representations of the world rather than actual firsthand engagement with it.
Wittenberg Professor Lowell Monkey. On April 18th, Monkey will speak at Antioch College on Unplugging Narcissists, Why a High-Tech Society Needs a High-Touch Childhood. You can hear more with Lowell Monkey on our website at wyso.org.
I sit two stories above the street. It's awful quiet, isn't love fell asleep? There's life down below me, though. Kids are walking home from school. Some long ago when we were taught that for whatever kind of puzzle you got, you just stick the right formula in, the solution for every fool. I remember the time when I came so close to.
Thanks for joining us this Sunday morning. I'm Jerry Kenny. Today on WISO Weekend, Conrad Balliet speaks to poet Kathy Austin, a Yellow Springs native now living in Dayton. Austin says she's been writing poetry since she learned to read and write.
I remember going to my father's bookcase, and he was an educator, so he had a lot of books. And I found one of his college poetry anthologies. Yes, I was reading Longfellow and Robert Frost.
And did you start
poets.
Writing in their styles?
No, not really. I started writing, but I pretty much had my own style at that time.
Way back at 8.
Yes.
And how do you describe that style?
It was free verse, and it had certain themes. I was really attracted to nature, especially as a child, and I still write poems about nature now. I'm also interested in spiritual poems and relationships and travel.
You find the allusions to nature fascinating. Do you have an example of your own poetry about nature?
Yes, I brought a poem called Deer, and it was written when we were out in Montana. And I felt very close to nature there, and I wanted to be one with nature. So this poem is about that. From the cabin, I can see two deer on the curved ridge. With heads down, they could be a mirror outcrop of the brown hill above a deep patch of snow, a bump, a brown silhouette. But their heads raise often, look forward, behind, watchful. Yesterday I saw large cat prints in fresh snow nearby. Still, I want to be with them on that ridge, a thin, graceful body against an infinite sky. But the mercury hovers near the bulb, and even with the bulky warmth of winter coat, the clunky boots, padded gloves and hood, even if I hefted myself up the steep hill, I'd hardly belong up there, would never arc and run quickly enough from the leap.
Lovely. Now, do most of your poems come to you by inspiration, or is there a lot of sweat equity in what you do?
They usually come from inspiration. It can be a memory or a word or a phrase or something that I saw that day. I have several poems based on the travel that I've taken over my lifetime. One of them is from Ireland. It's called Passport Photo. In the tiny strip of prints, I am barely there. Square after square, just a thin outline of me. The woman clips the only good one for the passport. There I am for the next 10 years, smiling, bug-eyed, ready for anything. Later, in the Shannon Airport, I whip it out. A customs agent stamps a page, and suddenly I am in Ireland, surrounded by a sea of redheads, brilliant green stone-lined pastures, wave-washed cliffs, rocky crags littered with sheep. And there I am, sitting in a crowded pub, with my faintly Irish nose, listening to a rosy-cheeked lass singing "O Danny Boy" as she plays her Irish harp. A beaming old woman, bent and gray, jumps up to dance the Irish quick step, everyone clapping, while just outside a castle wall standing for centuries, stone to stone, waits silently in darkness as forgotten ancestors dancing along stir the trees in the woods behind.
Oh, I don't know if it's possible to get homesick for somewhere that isn't your home. It's wonderful description and wonderful memories for me. Thanks for sharing that one. And you said memory is also a source of your poetry.
Oh, definitely. I have a number of poems based on memory. One of them is called Hiding. This was something that I wrote based on a memory from childhood because I was an only child. And sometimes I just needed to get away from my friends and be by myself. Several years out of the womb, I was still choosing places to hide, slipping into a linen closet I made my own, crouching in the dark as I wrote notes to myself when I grew old enough to spell, and tucked them into a crack of the darkened wall, or picked a more unlikely place to hide, unobstructed, full sun, the middle of a sweet clover prairie behind my house, tall enough to hide me in if I scooted down to eye level with the bees busy picking pollen. Friends called and called, but I sat there as silent as the grass.
Well, I'm glad you have come out of hiding and have been willing to talk on the air about your poetry and your experiences. I find a lot of very moving things that touch me at a personal level, and that's a good thing for a poet to do.
Thank you.
Thank you, Kathy Austin.
April is Poetry Month, and Saturday, April 20th at the Dayton Public Library, you can meet Conrad Balliot and other local poets. That's it for this week's edition of WISO Weekend on WYSO, Yellow Springs, Dayton, Springfield, and online at WYSO.org. I'm Jerry Kenney. Thanks to all our guests, and thank you for listening to member-supported public radio WYSO. Coming up next, The Book Nook.
Hi, I'm Nina Ellis, the general manager of WYSO. Our silent auction is Saturday, April 20th. Bid on tickets to the Dayton Dragons, dining at the Winds Cafe and Coco's Bistro, and new this year in the live auction, a Napa Valley getaway for two. So come and have some fun. All your public radio friends are going to be there at the Hollenbeck Bailey Conference Center in Springfield. Let off some steam. Saturday, April 20th. Tickets are at WYSO.org.